Arkadio Padilla. Welcome to KBOO.
Hey, Bill. Good to be here.
Arkadio Padilla wrote a wonderful article for the journal Science for the People. It's titled Co-ops, Climate, and Capital. It discussed this country's rural electrification cooperatives, whose history and function as he studied, examined their beginnings as part of the Roosevelt government's New Deal effort and the Great Depression by building the infrastructure for economic development. Looking back, rural electrification is seen as one of the great New Deal successes, with now over 900 RECs, rural electrification cooperatives. At the beginning, many envisioned the RECs as democratic and egalitarian, with its members, most of the community active in committees, actually coming to meetings, participating, as is their right, to making decisions about the RECs' direction and growth and relationships to the overall locality that they're in. That utopian idea, that never happened as a complete and comprehensive system anywhere, but even today some are struggling to make the RECs more active in the climate action struggle, trying to get them to accelerate their very slow movement towards renewables. Most RECs, however, remain conservative, and some have opposed climate action and clean power regulation. So, RK, first give us the history of the rural electrification cooperatives.
Sure thing, Bill. So, yeah, like you already mentioned, there's a whole bunch of rural electric co-ops across the country, you know, serving 40 million people, which means, you know, since they're co-ops, this means there's 40 million members of electric co-ops around the country. And their landmass basically covers the bulk of America's rural areas. So, you know, chances are if you're traveling outside of a city and you're looking around and you're seeing, you know, electric poles and wires, that's all going to be infrastructure that's owned by these co-ops. So it's this really interesting, fairly radical looking institution that's across America and mostly, you know, in these kind of what are now deep red Republican regions. But they have this nonprofit, democratically controlled electric utility versus, you know, in most cities, including Portland, I believe the electric grid is run by private investor-owned utilities. So interesting legacy. It stretches back to, like you mentioned, the 1930s, and it was part of the New Deal. So at the time, there weren't even any co-ops, really no public utilities in the electric sector. At the same time, there was a big discrepancy between urban life in America and rural life. I think the stat that was thrown around back then a lot was that something like 90% of urban residents had some access to electricity. At the same time, 90% of rural residents had no access to electricity. So there was an inequality there that people wanted to address, especially those living in rural areas. And, you know, at the same time, this is the Great Depression. You know, capitalism was in crisis. There was a lot more suffering than usual going on. So the Roosevelt administration was looking for ways to invest in some infrastructure somewhere, develop certain areas, et cetera, et cetera. So it was in around 1935, 1936 that the administration passed the Rural Electrification Act and set up the Rural Electrification Administration. And what they did, basically spend a bunch of money to electrify the countryside. Now, what's interesting is that they first actually wanted to team up with the investor-owned utilities. They shot down the proposal. They said, nah, there's not enough profit in rural America. You know, we don't want to spend that money for the low amounts of money we'll get back for it. So we're not interested. So what the government ended up deciding was, well, okay, let's go with, why don't we just help organize these rural areas. Let's find people locally that want to establish their own co-op. Let's give them a bunch of loans, and then they can basically use that to set up their own poles and wires, lay out the line, talk to their local communities, and basically electrify themselves. So that's basically the genesis of rural electric co-ops, and it's really seen as one of the best planks of the New Deal. Very successfully helped electrify most of rural America. I think by the 50s, certainly by the 60s, electricity rates in rural U.S. were on par with urban areas. And on top of that, it was all owned by locals on a nonprofit, democratic basis where, you know, they would vote on who ran their board. The workers would be local. You know, it was all locally owned, nonprofit institution. Now, there are some nuances. First off is that additional rationale for why would the Roosevelt administration maybe invest this much money into this kind of institution? At the time, there was a lot of talk and a lot of, you know, angst about social unrest in America. And there was actually, if you look back, a lot of the unrest was happening in rural areas. And there was talk amongst a lot of politicians about how much the underdevelopment of rural America was a potential source of disruption and political radicalism in the country. And I think that makes sense if you kind of look at some of the history of some of the, you know, old school radical groups at the time. The Knights of Labor, very fascinating group that was very big in both the South and the Northeast, did a lot of organizing of co-ops across large swaths of America that wanted to establish a cooperative commonwealth. They had influence on the populist movement, which was, I think, very much a kind of a rural movement that wanted to basically, you know, overthrow the capitalist elites of America. This was around the 1880s. They had influence on the IWW. That, I think, was more of a urban movement, but it definitely had some connections with kind of the peripheries of the Western U.S. So basically, the poverty and underdevelopment of rural America was becoming quite frightening to American political elites, and they wanted to figure out how to solve this. And, you know, again, with FDR, they had this kind of Keynesian outlook saying, all right, let's develop these areas. Let's kind of bring, quote-unquote, civilization to these regions. And, you know, let's try to calm people down and alleviate some poverty, right? So on one hand, you know, of course, it's a great thing that they were able to bring electricity. At the same time, it's interesting to see this kind of political motivation. You can even call it maybe some kind of almost counterinsurgency to try to stabilize society at that point while also stabilizing capitalism. And then, of course, the other dimension of that was that, you know, again, co-ops, you say cooperatives, right? And a lot of people, I think, especially amongst progressives, we have this very romantic notion of co-ops as this community institution. And I think it's a good model to have. In practice, what actually happens with co-ops and how are they actually set up, that has a lot of influence in how democratic and how cooperative and how community oriented these actually are. But really what the government wanted was to stabilize capitalism. They wanted to create and unlock these massive pools of aggregate demand and kind of support America's manufacturing sector. If they can get electricity to this big pool of poor rural folks, well, suddenly you got a big pool of electricity consumers, increased demand for electrical machinery, electrical appliances, et cetera, et cetera. And that could, you know, help kickstart rural capitalism. It could help kickstart the industrialization of agriculture in large swaths of the country. And it can kind of create this new consumer base in areas that were in many ways, you know, kind of separated from the larger economy. Yeah, these are cooperatives, but the main purpose was to set up this new kind of technological frontier and spread this kind of consumer ethos, right? So basically what ended up happening then was that a lot of these co-ops, when it was all done and settled, they didn't look that different from other utilities. Now, they had a technical democratic structure. They were nonprofit, right? So they weren't nodes of capital accumulation. But, you know, they were run by a small group of managers and experts. They didn't really go out of their way to involve the whole community or spread knowledge about electrical engineering or power systems, et cetera, et cetera. And they kind of, you know, became these kind of closed-off technocracies. And that kind of, you know, leads into the situation today where that's still kind of the case. And so, and that's how you get a situation now where you have these cooperatives, these kind of radical looking institutions across large swaths of America, but they're not really doing that much. Despite the climate crisis, despite growing energy crises, they're kind of coasting on just kind of doing the bare minimum of getting electricity to their members, which is good. But I think in this current moment, we can all agree that we would like to see a lot more done on that front.
Yeah. My sense of the 30s and the co-op movement began with reading about the plywood industry in Oregon, which completely collapsed during the Great Depression. The workers said, what the hell, let's run the plants. Maybe we can make a living and keep them open, or else we go on unemployment and maybe lose our homes and all the rest. These were industrial workers. They had all the know-how necessary to run the plant, and they did. For 30 or 40 years, the worker-owned plants, there were about 13 of them in Oregon, were, in fact, the utopian institutions that would have satisfied the conditions of real radical democracy, where people made where the line workers in the plants made the important decisions. They hired the administrators, and they debated and they discussed. That all ended, unfortunately, the plywood industry, because these places became so. They modernized, they had the best equipment, and the corporations swooped in. We'd love to own these factories. And so, of course, these people became instant millionaires. Recently, there's been ferment in the industry, at least in some of them. Talk about that and tell us about the ferment and where it came from.
Yeah, so it's interesting. Ferment really started in the rec sector around the 60s and 70s. You had a lot of people from the countercultural movement that kind of found themselves in co-op territory, and they realized, hey, there's electric co-ops here. That's interesting. You know, we were trying to set up our own co-ops in other parts of the economy, food co-ops, et cetera, during the 60s and 70s. So there's one really interesting case out in Vermont at Washington Electric Co-op, when basically a bunch of like ex-hippies found themselves in co-op territory, realized they were in a co-op, and tried to act as information. They wanted to say, oh, hey, how do we get involved? You know, we love co-ops. And management of that co-op was disinterested. They were like, all right, listen, you know, we're not that kind of co-op. You know, we don't really want to let you in our meetings, et cetera, et cetera. And that kind of pissed this group off. So they started organizing, started talking to neighbors, canvassing neighborhoods and whatnot. And they basically created a grassroots movement. This was in the 70s and 80s. Created this grassroots movement to basically try to democratize, you know, what was already supposed to be this democratic institution. And, you know, it had some twists and turns, but they eventually did basically manage to take over the co-op with their movement and institute a bunch of reforms. They started having more community engagement, you know, actually trying to give information about electric generation, et cetera, to members. And also, you know, it's good to note that this was in the context of the 70s after the 73 and 79 energy crisis. So energy and energy prices and energy generation, this is all becoming a much bigger part of what people were thinking about on a day-to-day basis. This is when the environmental movement kind of came about. And, you know, these rec movements kind of have intersection with that, too. One thing they did at Washington Electric Co-op, basically, they decided to get most of their electricity from a landfill natural gas plant, which is in some ways renewable, using some of the waste locally and creating a local generating plant. So that's one of the earlier ones. Then there's been an uptick in the similar movements. There was a pretty big movement at Purdon Alice Cooperative in Texas against corporate mismanagement, kind of similar story, people, you know, grassroots mobilizing against a intransigent management. You had contested elections at a Holy Cross electric co-op out in Colorado, centered in Aspen, where people organized really around trying to get more renewable energy and energy efficiency measures in place. And then you've also had movements in Eastern Kentucky around Eastern Kentucky Power Cooperatives, which has a bunch of generation, a lot of coal plants. And so there was a lot of interest among some local groups to try to organize through the cooperative to transition away from coal. So there's been a lot of movements like this, you know, and it's been growing kind of lockstep with people's interest in the climate crisis, realizing that these co-ops could be a force for change. Now, as you mentioned, there's been some limits to this stuff. In some cases, they have succeeded in pushing some better policies here and there. But, you know, one thing that keeps that really stuck out to me when I was reading about this stuff was the somewhat limited nature of these movements in terms of who's involved. I call it the class composition of these movements. You know, by and large, these movements are mostly driven by middle-class professional people, you know, and basically this is the kind of people that you would expect to be involved in local politics. And, you know, personally, I think that is a limitation. You know, on one hand, you know, you don't have the numbers to really generate the kind of pressure and movement to like really take over something like an electric utility and really push broad-based popular policies without that kind of like broad class base. And also, you know, secondly, I think that for progressives in the U.S., you know, I think our goal is generally to create kind of like mass working class movement to solve, you know, a lot of the problems that's afflicting this country, especially in energy and climate. And so, yeah, I just noticed that aspect of these movements around cooperatives, and it's one of those limitations. And it kind of keeps these co-ops as mainly being more technocratic, right? Like these movements are trying to solve policy issues, but they're not really tackling more fundamental questions about, you know, what does it mean to have, say, economic democracy? What does it mean to have a cooperative society? Are we really exploring the full potential of electric co-ops and what they could be doing for society and democracy and the economy in general? Yeah, those are some of my thoughts. It really centers on the class composition of some of these movements.
Bill Resnick here for the Old Mole Variety Hour here on KBOO, talking to R.K. Upadhya, an electrical engineer, a historian of rural electrification cooperatives. But rural electric industry, the cooperatives, never became real cooperatives. It seems to me to discuss how now in our emerging era, which is dominated by the existential threat of climate change, why the great majority of folks have withdrawn from civic participation for many, many reasons. But how now, facing the great threat of climate change, it seems to me possible to help them get active and to really build a force that can contend with the capitalist community for who should direct the mobilization necessary to deal with climate change. What are your ideas as to how that force could be, how the activation could occur?
I do have some ideas about this, and, you know, emphasis on ideas, because I'm quite frankly not 100% sure about any of this. Yeah, I mean, like you mentioned, our country, we really have a lack of broad-based popular participation in local politics and local institutions and civic life. We got plenty of participation, you know, at the national level. Everyone always wants to talk about what's happening nationally or what the drama of the week is. But, you know, you talk to people about local issues, let alone local energy issues, you know, people don't really understand or they're not able to follow this stuff. And I think there's a lot of factors in that. One factor I mentioned in my piece is that is kind of this much kind of wider and deeper dynamic that we get in capitalist societies where it kind of stems from the very division of labor, you know, where some people are able to work on and actually accumulate knowledge about these complex technological systems like energy and electricity and distribution systems and whatnot. But most people are not. They're not able to really have the time to really accumulate that knowledge. And it can be very challenging to do that on your own. And so when you get in that situation, well, how are you supposed to really substantively participate in something like a co-op, even if that opportunity is available to you, right? That's an obstacle, this lack of knowledge and even a lack of time. You know, if people are working all day to put food on a table, how are you supposed to put in the work, because it is work, to engage in local democratic institutions? So in some ways, I think our society kind of creates these structural barriers to people participating in what is technically, you know, democratic institutions locally and in the energy system. So the question of how to overcome that gets even more complicated, I guess, and difficult to answer. I suggest in my piece that basically we got to think a bit more radically about what do we want cooperatives to do, especially, you know, electric cooperatives. And also, you know, this also applies to municipal utilities, I think. Thinking about how they can actually start to address things beyond just the supply of energy or even just the decarbonization of electricity. Thinking about, all right, can we actually expand cooperatives in the cooperative form beyond electricity into other sectors of the economy? Actually, what's interesting is some co-ops are already doing this. They're expanding into telecommunications. They're laying fiber lines to get internet access to people in their territory, and thus taking away that market from private utilities. I think that's pretty neat. But, you know, we can think even more, like, what if electric co-ops or other co-ops tried to create cooperative housing? What if they tried to expand cooperative farms more? Speaking of future energy technologies like electric vehicles, what if they tried to set up cooperative electric vehicle repair shops, you know, take that market share away from companies like Tesla and Ford, who want to keep that stuff proprietary? And in this way, I think you kind of open up. It's not just the issue of energy and this issue of kind of wonky policy anymore. It's something that starts to touch more people's lives and in that sense starts to make more, you know, appeal to ordinary working class folks and say, hey, this isn't just this abstract climate issue. We can actually use this co-op to kind of start to restructure our society and we can improve our lives, you know, in a very concrete manner. I think that's kind of one idea I try to discuss a bit in my piece. But, you know, I will say, I think in general, the real problem, I think, is that society in America is very depoliticized and atomized, right? People don't really have institutions that can really generate even these kinds of political discussions we're having right now, right? They don't have a way to act collectively. And I think that really, before we even talk about co-op reform movements or utility reform movements, we have to talk about kind of countering that tendency. How do we actually build movements and organizations and networks that can really bring people back together to act in a collective manner? I think, you know, until you get that, you're not going to even if you have an excellent proposal for co-ops, you're not really going to be able to generate the people power and the popular movement to put that into action. And I think you have to, I'll just say, I think you got to build these movements from basically organizing where people are at and based on their concrete interests. And that probably starts in things like union movements and tenant movements that can really bring people together around issues that affect their day-to-day lives. And then on top of that, we can start to build, all right, movements for democratizing the utility and so on.
Yeah, we have to end, unfortunately. My contribution to it, I think, is to point out it's not necessary for a democratic left to prevail to, in fact, have all of those forces ready so that the capitalist establishment just decides to surrender as the better part of discretion. There's going to be a crisis soon when the methane hydrates begin melting, when the permafrost is producing methane and carbon dioxide in huge quantities across the globe as the globe warms. But it seems to me the current situation is extremely unstable, and it will not, if you believe the climate scientists, ever stabilize except for a great mobilization of our resources in many, many areas to stop climate change. And I think when the crisis comes, people will see it. And then it's going to be a struggle between the capitalist establishment, who will say, I'm really sorry, we made some mistakes, we should have acted sooner, but really, we're the people who can make things happen. So just give us the power to direct that mobilization. And they're going to be relatively convincing and have huge amounts of money and do what they do. But the people will actually see things in their communities. It seems to me that gives the left an opportunity to build out models of what could be done. And in a struggle between us and them, they've been delegitimated, and nobody likes the big corporations who have, in fact, ignored what's happened for 40 years. My sense is that the left answer could prevail. What we do need is a contending force that can make those arguments, that can show people that the left program will work and is working. Some of the model cities we have are very important. I wish there were 10 times as many. Anyway, that's my final contribution. You get the last word.
I think you're right that we do have some good ideas that people will take up in times of crisis. And all my critiques aside, I do think the cooperative model is one of those. Hopefully when push comes to shove, people will look to local co-ops and local municipal utilities and say, hey, let's do something with this. And we can.
Very good talking to you. I recommend your article in the new version of Science for the People, Co-ops, Climate, and Capital by R.K. Upadhyay. Thanks a lot.
Thanks for having me on.